Coming up, fighting the AIDS pandemic in Kenya. A clinic founded 20 years ago by a doctor from Indiana now serves some 60,000 patients. And Chabad Lubavitch, a look at the movement behind the Jewish Outreach Center that was attacked in Mumbai, India.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Mourning continued around the world in the wake of the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, India. Nearly 200 people were killed in the 60-hour siege of several sites, and hundreds of others were wounded. Among the dead were two Americans on a spiritual pilgrimage with the Synchronicity Foundation, a meditation community in Virginia. In Israel, thousands of Orthodox Jews attended funerals for six people killed at Mumbai's Chabad House, an outreach center run by the Chabad Lubavitch movement within Hasidic Judaism. The Chabad headquarters in New York solicited mitzvot, or good deeds, in their memory. We'll have more about Chabad later in the program. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict XVI led special prayers for all the victims and called the siege cruel and senseless violence. Islamic groups around the world also condemned the attacks, which have been linked to Muslim militants from Pakistan. The Muslim Council of Britain said this was a case where a few terrorists, quote, bring the entire faith into disrepute. Joining me with more about the implications of all of this is Timothy Shaw, Adjunct Senior Fellow for Religion and Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Tim, welcome. Tell us how religion was tied up in this.
In a number of ways, and really two big ways in particular. First is that the group that was most likely involved in these terrible attacks in Mumbai was not just a militant group, as we often see in the press, but it was a group motivated by a religious ideology. The group is known as Lashkar-e-Taiba, which means Army of the Pure, and it continues to operate openly in Pakistan today. It has reconstituted itself as a faith-based NGO, but it is still a radical Islamic organization motivated by religious ideology. The second way in which religion is involved is that these attacks help to intensify a very volatile mix of religion and politics in India, which especially involves the Hindu nationalist movement and its political wing, the BJP.
Now, where does this leave India's Muslim population?
It raises some questions and suspicions in the minds of many Indians and also people outside of India as to whether India's very large Muslim community was in some way involved in this, if not as the prime instigators, perhaps as accomplices. India has a very large Muslim community. It's the third largest Muslim population in the world, making India the third largest Muslim country in the world of about 130 million people. And so there are questions. So far, no concrete evidence, I should emphasize, but there are questions and suspicions about the role of India's Muslims.
But India's Muslims have not been part of some of these movements by and large, is that correct?
That's right. There have been a number of attacks, terrorist attacks in India in the last 5 or 6 years, and there has been evidence in some cases of local homegrown Muslim groups involved. One group is called the Students Islamic Movement of India, SIMI. That has been involved in some attacks, but by and large, the vast majority of India's Muslims are not only not involved in these kinds of attacks, but have no sympathy whatsoever with them.
And you mentioned because of there's also a violent streak in some of the Hindu nationalist movement
absolutely.
As well, that this really puts the future of India as a multi-faith democracy in jeopardy.
That's right. In fact, it's actually very striking that in the last few weeks, a Hindu terror network was uncovered by Indian police. And there are some elements of the Hindu nationalist movement that have violent tendencies. We've seen one group, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad or World Hindu Council, conduct very violent attacks against Christians in eastern India and Orissa just in the last few weeks and months. So, yes, and one really fears that in the light of these attacks, these groups would really want to attack Muslims and other religious minorities in a more dramatic way.
All right. Tim Shaw from the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll continue this conversation on our website at pbs.org. In other news, conservatives who have left the U.S. Episcopal Church have announced the formation of a new rival church body. They're calling it the Anglican Church in North America, and they say it would represent some 100,000 members in the U.S. and Canada. The move comes after years of tension within the Episcopal Church over homosexuality and other theological issues. The new group hopes to be aligned with the worldwide Anglican Communion. But traditionally, there has only been one Anglican province or jurisdiction in a given region, and the Episcopal Church says it is that jurisdiction. Bishop Robert Duncan, whose Pittsburgh diocese voted to leave the Episcopal Church, will be Archbishop of the new church body.
I think what the Lord is doing is the Lord is displacing the Episcopal Church. The reality is that the mainstream Episcopal Church has separated from the mainstream of Anglicanism and from the mainstream of Christianity.
Nearly 3 million Muslims from around the world are gathering in Saudi Arabia for their annual Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. The Hajj is considered one of the five pillars of the Islamic faith, and all Muslims are supposed to make the pilgrimage at least once in their lives if they're physically and financially able to do so. The Hajj ends with the three-day holiday of Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice. Catholic pilgrims heading to their shrine in Lourdes, France, are in for some changes. The medical committee of Lourdes is getting out of the business of determining miracles. Some 6 million pilgrims come to the Lourdes Shrine to the Virgin Mary every year. Many are seeking miraculous healing from the water there. In 1954, the church set up the panel of doctors to help decide which cures were indeed miracles. Now the doctors say that has become too complicated, so they will only determine which cases are remarkable, not miraculous. This past week was the 20th anniversary of World AIDS Day. President Bush marked the day at a special forum hosted by pastor and best-selling author Rick Warren. Warren honored the Bush administration's efforts to combat AIDS around the world, especially in Africa. Americans are involved in the AIDS crisis on many fronts. Fred DeSam Lazaro has a story today about an American doctor whose clinic serves some 60,000 AIDS patients in Kenya. His church back home in Indiana supports his work.
From its location on the edge of the city, the North United Methodist Church in Indianapolis boasts a number of global ties.
Joseph, please come up here and join me as we welcome you.
None are closer than those to Kenya.
As you know, we've been praying with and for you and for the people of Kenya. It helps us to know a little bit from you. How are things now?
The honored guest told of the deadly post-election violence in his country.
Of course, we see at the peak the leaders have made some kind of agreement, but down the grassroots, it's still smoldering.
The Kenya connection traces back almost two decades to one couple from this congregation. In recent months, Joseph and Sarah Ellen Mamlin have brought them news from the front lines of a distant conflict. Dr. Joseph Mamlin first visited here in the late 80s to set up an exchange program between his employer, Indiana University School of Medicine, and a med school in the western Kenyan city of Eldoret. He returned a decade later to a worsening AIDS problem here and decided to stay on and set up a small HIV clinic, or so he thought.
It grew to where I had 1,500 patients out of this one room, and they were just lying all around on the ground. We had the largest village-based HIV clinic in Kenya, and we were just working out of this one room. And then I was home visiting my children and grandchildren years ago, and someone called my wife and asked to meet her at JCPenney at a shopping mall, and she just anonymously handed her a check and said, Joe needs a clinic. And this is what you see here. This is all from an anonymous donor in Indianapolis from the church. We had the National Minister of Health and the U.S. Ambassador here dedicating, but that's not the real dedication. Here, I see a beautiful lady coming by here. Hey, Rose. This is Rose Biergen.
Hi, Fred.
She's one of the very first patients I treated here many years ago. And I'm the one looking sick now instead of her. But she was essentially dying with PCP pneumonia. She was almost a dead woman.
Today she runs the clinic's outreach program. The miracle of her recovery began in this pharmacy. It's well stocked with antiretroviral drugs for HIV, thanks to a major grant from the U.S. government's President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR.
Look what we have here. This is PEPFAR in action. People who've been in this business and watching people die in Kenya will walk in a room like this, they will cry. To see this umbilical cord to life made available by the American people, free of charge for all of these patients, is a miracle. And it's just simply wonderful.
Today, some 60,000 patients receive care in 18 regional centers. Mamlin notes only two American doctors work alongside several hundred Kenyan colleagues and staff, a staff so dedicated, he says, that many were on the front lines of emergency care during the turmoil. None of the acrimony from the ethnic violence that followed December's elections spilled into the compounds of their clinics. Many employees took shelter in the project's compound. Even though they were from tribes fighting each other on the outside, they drew on faith to stay together inside.
We had a group, a Christian group. We had prayers. We had to sing together. We had to pray together. That united us, that we could not rise against one another.
We need to believe that we can have peace back, and we need it. We had hope.
But all around them, the devastation did not spare even churches. The toll not just in death and property damage, but also interruption in the careful drug regimens for AIDS patients.
I want you to know that missing your medicine even 2 days is dangerous. I know you could do nothing. It's not your fault.
The most immediate challenge was in tracking down the thousands of patients who fled the violence, making sure they were supplied with their drugs. Many scattered into makeshift camps for displaced people, some of which still remain. 37-year-old Purity Wambui took shelter in this church. She got a coveted indoor spot since she has a newborn. That makes life easier, but hardly easy.
The health becomes deteriorated because you have nothing to eat. At times we were eating, before we were eating a balanced diet, but now it's hard to get that balanced diet. We just rely on maize and yellow peas. Milk. Milk is a dream.
Nonetheless, she's grateful not just for the drugs that have kept her alive, but for provisions the Indiana Partnership distributes to her entire family. It's the middle step in restoring patients, says Mamlin. Each day there are tough calls to make on how to disperse limited funds.
You have no school fees.
Mamlin turned down this mother's request for school fees.
To whom it may concern, that's usually my middle name. No, you have to see Diana, social worker. There's so many of these, it's impossible for me to do all of them. Do you want to reconstitute immune systems, or do you want to reconstitute lives? And those are two totally different problems. And we've decided to go after lives. We're taking care of the poorest of the poor.
It's a choice that may be rooted in faith, but faith is a matter Mamlin does not share publicly.
I have much more concern about what needs to be done as an expression of whatever faith system we have. I guess I'm raised in a tradition that tends to avoid putting things like that on your shoulder.
There's a wise old church leader who said, "Preach the gospel and if necessary, use words."
Back in Indianapolis, Pastor Armstrong says what began as a public health program has also spawned numerous exchanges between worship communities here and in Kenya. For the Hoosiers, he says, it's widened their understanding of a distant land and a complex epidemic, and it's helped them spiritually.
Who are the people you want your children to learn the Christian faith from? The Mamlins would be at the top of that list. And so for us to be able to find some way to be alongside them in their journey, not only was a way for us to strengthen our friendship, but also for us to deepen our own faith.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro.
As we mentioned earlier, the Jewish Outreach Center attacked in Mumbai was part of the Chabad Lubavitch movement within Hasidic Judaism. Of the several Hasidic groups, the Chabad Lubavitch movement is by far the most visible, with a presence in some of the most remote corners of the world. I did a story about Chabad a few years ago. Rabbi Shay Harlig is on a mission to get Jews to embrace a more traditional practice of their faith. As an emissary of the Chabad Lubavitch movement, he works nearly nonstop. He leads prayer services and Torah studies.
When I come in, you're all going to be sitting in a circle.
He and his wife, Dina, sponsor a Jewish school for children.
It's all kosher for Passover.
And they promote keeping a kosher diet. The rabbi is waging his campaign in what may seem an unlikely mission field. Las Vegas, Nevada.
Once you get away from the strip, it's like any other city, except that you have slot machines in every grocery store.
The Harligs are part of a vast and sometimes controversial effort aimed at Jews in every corner of the globe. It was the vision of the late Chief Lubavitcher Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who led the Lubavitch movement for more than 40 years. Lubavitchers simply call him the Rebbe.
The Rebbe established what you might call an outreach program decades ago, the intention to reach out to Jewish people, wherever they are, whoever they are, regardless of background, to teach them about their faith.
Schneerson emphasized traditional Hasidic teachings, strict religious observance, and deep mysticism. He also preached that the coming of the Messiah, the Mashiach, was near.
The Rebbe has established that we should usher in the sage, when godliness will be revered to all and the struggle between good and evil will cease and there will be true peace in the world. So we look at our goal of bringing Jewish people closer is to that they should fulfill the mission. This is one of the ways we could hasten to speed up the coming of the Messiah.
Like other Hasidic groups, Lubavitchers fled persecution and political upheaval in Europe, bringing their 18th century way of life to 20th century America. They established a flourishing community in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, which has become the movement's international headquarters. While other Hasidic groups maintained a strict focus inward, the Rebbe instructed his followers to spread the Chabad Lubavitch vision outward.
He often said he could not rest until every Jewish child, every Jewish person, was afforded a proper Jewish education to know how to live as a Jew and as a human being.
Married men and women, called shlichim, emissaries, were dispatched around the world to establish Chabad centers, even in places where there were only a few Jews. They call themselves the Rebbe's Army, and they've enlisted for life.
To gather together, all of us together, to gain this strength, to be true soldiers in the Rebbe's Army.
There are more than 4,000 emissary couples in 47 U.S. states and 73 foreign countries.
Romania!
Roll calls at Lubavitch meetings such as this women's conference show their massive reach. There's a special emphasis on Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, where the Lubavitch movement has its roots.
Most of the people in the country through the 75 years of communism were totally, totally deprived of any knowledge of Judaism.
But emissaries are also in other challenging places. They've led special services in Nepal, and they've lit a Hanukkah menorah in Las Vegas. Such a mission field was just what Shay and Dina Harlig were looking for when they arrived more than a decade ago, shortly after their marriage.
All the pieces.
There was no kosher food, no ritual bath, little Jewish education. So the Harligs set to work. Today, they've opened a new $1.5 million Chabad Center, with regular prayer services in the shul, or synagogue,
and a mikveh, a bath, for women's monthly purification rituals.
Keep kosher? Are you keeping, you learning about kosher?
Rabbi Harlig is now the local kosher food supervisor.
Hello.
Several grocery stores sponsor entire kosher food sections. And there are several kosher restaurants, including a Chinese restaurant, Shalom Hunan.
Light those candles Friday night, make the world a bit more bright.
They established the Torah Tots Preschool and the Desert Torah Academy with grades K through 4. The instruction is both secular and religious. Most of the parents are non-Chabad Jews.
We have the parents really involved as much as we can, and we explain a lot what we do in our whatever program we do. We always explain and have them understand what's going on.
Rabbi Harlig teaches Jews that observance and good deeds are a way to enhance spirituality and connect with God. Lynn and Arnie Rosenkrantz are members of a conservative congregation who've participated in Rabbi Harlig's classes and donated to Chabad projects.
They make me hungry to learn more. They encourage me and motivate me to learn more about Judaism, to be a better Jew, to aspire to be the best kind of Jew that I can.
But Lubavitchers also generate controversy, especially because of their messianic beliefs. Schneerson died in 1994. He had not designated a successor. Lubavitchers believe he is still guiding them. Every year, people flock to his gravesite in Queens, where they seek his intervention for miracles. Chabad leaders say every shaliach, or emissary, continues to be inspired by the Rebbe.
I would say that there's not a shaliach in the world who, and all the members of his or her family, that don't feel the Rebbe constantly looking over their shoulder. His blessing is almost palpable. The success is so phenomenal.
At the time of Schneerson's death, some Lubavitchers believed the Rebbe himself was Mashiach, the Messiah. That belief has persisted and apparently grown, something that offends many Orthodox Jews.
The belief that the messianic mission of the true Messiah would be interrupted by his death and burial in an unredeemed world is a position which Jews rejected, and rejected vigorously, vehemently. I believe that the belief itself is a betrayal of Judaism.
Chabad leaders are very reluctant to publicly discuss the extent to which Lubavitchers believe Schneerson was the Messiah.
We live in a free country. People can believe whatever they want. But it is certainly not an obligation upon anyone to campaign or to point fingers at anybody saying that this is Mashiach, this is a potential Mashiach, whatever. I think it's dangerous, actually. People don't understand what the whole concept of a Mashiach is really about. It's a delicate subject. And they can get lost in the quagmire.
It's possible. Who is it going to be for sure? I don't know. Most important thing is let's do our work. Let's bring as many Jews possible back to our sacred tradition, and the Messiah will show up, and whoever it's going to be as long as he finally comes.
And Rabbi Harlig says he's doing what he can to see Las Vegas get ready for the Messiah's arrival.
My hope is Mashiach should be here, and the Strip will be turned into big yeshivas, rabbinical schools. I envision all the big hotels with the thousands of rooms. It's going to be rabbinical students studying. That's my vision.
Russian Orthodox Patriarch Alexei II died this week at the age of 79. He had long suffered from heart disease. Alexei became patriarch in 1990 as the officially atheist Soviet Union was easing its persecution of religion. He oversaw the resurgence of the Russian Orthodox Church in the post-communist era, and he supported restrictions on faiths other than Orthodoxy. The Russian Church is the largest in the Eastern Orthodox tradition. Finally, Christmas celebrations are already in high gear in Bethlehem, the traditional birthplace of Jesus. Tourism officials are hoping for a banner season. They say the number of visitors to the Holy Land has surged in 2008 after several years of declines. Pilgrims come to the Palestinian town of Bethlehem to visit the 4th century Church of the Nativity, which is built on the site many Christians revere as the place where Jesus was born. Of course, after church, there's always time for a little Christmas shopping in Manger Square. That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. There's much more on our website, including my extended conversation with Tim Shaw about India and coverage about religion and politics on our One Nation page. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, Rissy Palmer singing What Child Is This at the lighting of the National Christmas Tree in Washington, D.C. this week.
The Christians fear of sins, the shadow.